Well may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General.
You know I've searched my heart to prove there's better ways to push and pull. Hey, whatever gets you through these days.
Hello and welcome to Well May We Say, a progressive podcast about Australian politics. This is episode 23 for Saturday, 3rd of June 2017. I'm Jeremy Sear, and each week I'll be joined by a different guest host to help me look into what's happening to our country, and why, what's going to happen, and what we can do about it. And tonight's guest host is returning guest host, Denise Pierco.
Hello.
We've got quite a few things to run through after, for some reason, us being off for a fortnight.
I can't imagine why we were away.
There's a small creature with your finger in her mouth, which indicates a reason.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
All right, well, tonight on Well May We Say, we're going to start off with the Uluru Statement of the Heart that happened this week. So there's been it's 50 years since the 1967 referendum, which was the one where we changed the constitution so that it did count Aboriginal Australians in the census. And also it removed the part of the Commonwealth power which said that you could make laws about races except for Aboriginal people, and allowed the Commonwealth to make laws about Aboriginal people specifically, which, keeping in mind the Northern Territory intervention and so forth, may not be...
the best.
May not have been a wonderful thing, but on the other hand, prior to that, it was the states who were making those laws, and they were even worse. It was this chaotic mess of...
And it was an inconsistent chaotic mess as well.
And quite brutal. And Aboriginal people didn't have any rights at all, really. It was quite, you know, without hyperbole, but it was when you went from one state to the other, you could suddenly find yourself sort of unable to even do the most basic sort of
work.
Civil liberties. Yeah. Well, the positive thing, as I understand it, of what that change did, apart from being a symbolic one, the positive effect of it being taken over by the Commonwealth was that it then became possible to lobby more effectively for things like land rights and mm-hmm. A lot of the Aboriginal institutions that were then established under Whitlam were then able to be established because they had the power now.
Yeah.
But I think the Tent Embassy was set up in, 1972? Because after 5 years of supposed progress after the referendum, nothing much had changed.
Yeah, that doesn't actually surprise me that nothing much had changed.
Well, 50 years later, again, nothing much has changed. In the last week, something has changed, but that's not in relation to Aboriginal people per se. There were talks up at Uluru this week after talks around the country between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, where they have formed a referendum council, and they have rejected finally any kind of symbolic recognition in the constitution being enough.
Yeah, they just don't want a little tick on a piece of paper saying this is Aboriginal land and that's it.
So I want to read, rather than paraphrase it, because clearly Barnaby Joyce didn't actually listen to what they said, he came out declaring that they wanted some kind of
a second Senate, he's talking about. He's like, oh, if they're going to have another chamber in the federal parliament, like, it's hard enough getting stuff done with our Senate, we're not going to do that. And it's like, that's not actually what they're asking for.
Yes. What did he say? He said, look, if you're asking for a new chamber in the federal parliament, and some of the articles I see are sort of heading in that direction, I mean, it's fudging there, that wasn't true. That's not going to happen. I'm just going to be fair dinkum with the people. We've got enough problems with the Senate we've got, we don't need another one. Now, I won't let myself be dragged off on a tangent about that one, because I did listen to, he says, lying and starting off on a tangent, because I did listen to the Sky News podcast this week, and the right are currently campaigning to have the Senate reformed. They're sort of starting to try and push towards the idea of changing the Senate so that the minor parties, small parties, which they are trying to portray as cranks and loons, like Pauline Hanson's One Nation, to be fair.
Yeah.
And again... another tangent, the craziness from Pauline Hanson's foundation this last fortnight.
Yeah.
But they're working... So where you and I might argue that the chamber of the parliament that needs reform is the House of Reps, where you can have 12% of the vote and be lucky to get one out of 150 seats, because it's a system that creates majorities in parliament from minorities of votes. And like every time they're like, well, the government has a mandate to do this. No, the party that has the majority of seats did not get a majority of the votes.
Yeah.
And frankly, the Senate should be blocking it. And although the Senate obviously is undemocratic in the sense that it's, you know, Tasmanian votes worth more than a New South Wales vote because it's the same number of seats but far fewer people, voting. Yeah, and I agree that that's undemocratic. But it turns out to be more democratic because it's proportional within those states, and people don't vote on state issues. So it turns out, even despite that dodginess, it ends up being more democratic. So I'd say the Senate isn't the problem. It's the House of Reps, and we need multi-member electorates. And I've said that before, and we're off on a tangent. So let's go back to this, back through Paul Kelly calling for reform to the Senate, back through Barnaby Joyce declaring that this was going to be a new Senate, all the way back to what was actually said by Aboriginal people in what was called the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And I'm going to read it because I think it's important to know what the Aboriginal people actually said, not what gets paraphrased.
Yes, absolutely it is.
So it said, "We, gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished and coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise that peoples possessed a land for 60 millennia and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionally, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children are alienated from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and to take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish. They will walk in two worlds and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations and truth-telling about our history. In 1967 we were counted, in 2017 we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future."
That's a really amazing statement. And I think there's a lot of truth in there that gets ignored a lot of the time, that the sovereignty does coexist with our own, that they are, that Aboriginal people are the most incarcerated, that they are still taken from their families, that all of this is happening and they don't have a voice. And I think it is important for that to happen and that change to happen.
I think the one that we miss a lot is that the land never got ceded.
Yeah.
They haven't, it's not been a, you know, there wasn't a war where they surrendered. There wasn't, it was an invasion where we just pretended they never existed.
Yes.
There hasn't ever been a treaty. There hasn't ever been an agreement with Aboriginal people.
You're right, it wasn't ceded. And so this basically is a call for a treaty between the Aboriginal people of Australia and Torres Strait Islanders and all post-colonial Australians. Makarrata is word for a treaty. It's a Yolngu word for treaty, and basically that's what they want. They want something where they sit down at a table and fairly deal with us.
I'm not quite sure how we can ever think that the matter is settled without a treaty. Like, White Australia, whose current attitude appears to be, we'll do some symbolic stuff. Although, keep in mind, Howard wouldn't even do a symbolic, sorry for the Stolen Generation, his attitude was, oh, well, it's just symbolic, it doesn't matter. Now symbolism is better because we don't want to do anything that actually has meaning and actually affects. So basically, as soon as white Australians think that they're losing something, their backs get up and they're like, no, I refuse to do it. And why should I have to do anything for things? I wasn't there. I didn't dispossess the land. I mean, you're freaking living on it. You're living on the bet. You're benefiting from that dispossession. It's just the staggering idea.
They are still being damaged by that dispossession.
And people like Joyce, who's that whole, and they do the same thing with refugees too. They're like, look, it's not us as parliamentarians. It's just that you can't, Australian people wouldn't accept it. Like, we've got to brutally persecute refugees on Nauru because otherwise Australian people wouldn't let us have an immigration policy. We've got to pander to the dickheads.
Mm, Yes.
Whilst also fostering the dickheads and that attitude.
And encouraging the dickheads and creating the dickheads.
And it's not really an excuse. Even if there are dickheads in the electorate who want us to be treat Aboriginal people appallingly.
Just because there are bullies out there doesn't mean that you do what the bullies want.
And it just staggers me, this idea that the same people who arc up at the idea of anybody questioning Anzac Day, or same people who in the Liberal Party who champion Robert Menzies, same people who, by the way, was the reason why the 1967 referendum didn't happen 10 years earlier. It happened in 1967 when they could get 90% of the vote. It didn't happen like when they got 50 or 60% when they could have got it over the line. It took much longer to get it through because Menzies resisted it for 10 years.
Yep.
And so it wasn't until he'd gone that they were able to get it through. Anyway, but my point is that we celebrate history all the time, which isn't something that any of us individually did. We celebrate the achievements of our ancestors. But for some reason, the idea of taking responsibility for any of the things that our ancestors did, particularly the things that we are still benefiting from now, apparently we're like, no, it wasn't me. You can't hold me responsible for the stuff that I'm benefiting from that my ancestors did, the same ones that I celebrate when it suits me.
Yeah, that's very true. It is definitely a one-way street, isn't it? We can reap the good from it, but we can't see any of the bad that could possibly stain it or stain that legacy.
Well, what is Australia Day? Like, we're supposed to celebrate Australia Day, when the First Fleet got here. But we can't take responsibility for what the First Fleet did?
Did, no, absolutely not.
Like, how do we have it both ways?
We can't, and that's the thing. I think that we can't. I think that we really need to have it both ways to change how that is. So far, it's pretty much the Greens who have endorsed this resolution.
Yes.
Labor said, oh, well, we're interested to see where things go, Ben. We'll read the final paper when it comes out.
Which, I mean, to be fair, it's not a formal proposal at the moment.
No, it's not.
But they could have indicated support for the general idea. But the problem is that they also, obviously, given their support for offshore detention, are happy to pander to racists.
Yes, which is sad and scary and not what I picture the Labor Party as. But it is.
Really? How long have you lived in Australia?
I've lived in Australia for 13 years. You think I would have learned better?
All right. Well, let's talking of racist macho bullshit.
Ooh, is there more?
Well, I don't know if we sort of should start off with this. Whether the beginning of this was actually Tony Abbott or One Nation. I think it was Tony Abbott. So we had Tony Abbott writing in the Daily Telegraph and the News Corp papers that the only safe jihadi is one who has been lawfully killed, imprisoned, or thoroughly converted from Islamism. We need to ensure that every returning jihadi can be readily charged and convicted, possibly through creation of special courts. Special courts.
Good.
That can hear evidence that may not normally be admissible.
Oh, like so evidence gained through things like torture, perhaps, or...
Which we know is not accurate.
Exactly, or like...
Sorry, but when we say evidence,
Exactly, the air quotes are fierce. Or not only that, like evidence gained through dodgy methods that hasn't been vetted in any way.
Apparently, this great Western tradition that Tony will happily champion, the rule of law, apparently it needs to be thrown out the window because it's not really that good. We can't really rely on it to catch people who commit crimes.
Well, no, exactly.
We've got to throw it out the window. What are the rules of evidence for? Why do we even develop those?
Well, rules of evidence are for white people. And witch hunts are for not white people.
Ah, makes sense. Well, Barnaby Joyce was trying to respond to Tony, and he came out with...
the most bizarre thing on the face of the earth.
So, apparently, if you're a homicidal maniac, you should join the army. This is what he said. Ah, well, you know, it's a question for the Attorney General. I think that we've got very strong anti-terrorism laws. If people want to break the law, they'll suffer the consequences. And, you know, people coming back from engagement overseas obviously means that they were overseas trying to murder people. And murdering is against the law. And if you want to go overseas and murder other people, well, you're an evil person. And if what you really want to do is be involved in a conflict, then join the Australian Army and do it legally.
So basically everyone in the Australian Army is evil? I'm kind of taking that away from that.
I don't think he's saying everyone's evil, but he's saying that if you are an evil homicidal maniac who does want to kill people...
Join the army! That would be a much better pre-movie advertisement sort of recruiting thing than the ones they have now. You know, like you go to the movies now and you see the world, this will be so exciting, you can be a comms person or something in the army. Instead they need to do this like whole, you could murder people legally. That would be a much better advertising campaign.
Well, it's like whenever people are talking about, whenever they joke about prison rape, they're like, that person will get raped in prison. Like, But who is doing the raping? Like, is there an official prison rapist? Have we got a policy now of being like, look, there's raping. Part of our justice system now does involve raping certain people in prison.
But also, why is that okay? You know, why is it okay to subjugate or take away someone else's rights or do something like that to someone else just because they did something horrible? Like, it's not.
I feel like if your job would appeal to terrible people, maybe there's a flaw to your job.
Oh, gosh.
On the other hand, I don't think that Barnaby is particularly accurate. I don't think that's a fair description of what... why people do join the Australian Defence Forces. Although, simultaneously, I also don't think it's what the Defence Force job ad that I saw this week was either. And it's called Meet the People Behind the Navy Uniform. And there are three people in it. And I'll play the audio now.
The looks on their faces when we actually gave it to them, they were just amazed. It was probably the best day of my life.
Finally got to go to America and compete in the wake skate tour against some of the best riders in the world, and it was a dream come true.
We decided that we'd meet in Bali for a bit of a holiday. Little did I know he was going to get down on one knee and propose.
We have two women. One woman who made quilts to give to kids. One woman who got proposed to. And one bloke who got to compete in sporty things.
Yes, exactly. Against his heroes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and you know, one got to have a holiday in Bali, which where her fiancé, her now fiancé, proposed to her. And the other one got to give some kids quilts. And it's just like, wow, that's... amazing.
That's how the Defence Forces apparently see women. That's like, what? Where did they come from? Very strange. All right.
But, I think the murdering thing would be a lot stronger than that.
Well, if we want to fill the army with homicidal maniacs. All right. So the reason why I thought it might also be One Nation is that I think it was Malcolm Roberts, one of the One Nation senators was trying to get the ASIO chief, Duncan Lewis, to declare that refugees were some kind of were linked with terrorism. And he came out and said, no, people become radicalized because they adopt a violent extremist interpretation of Sunni Islam. And he said, there's no evidence that there's a link between refugees and terrorism. Now, obviously, there have been refugees who have committed terrorist acts. And if you're the media and you only focus on the ones done by Muslims, then yes, it seems like, in particular, there are a lot of them that are connected with refugee people who claim to be refugees. And so the News Corp idiots, the ranters like Andrew Bolt, went off. How dare they, the ASIO, pretend that there's no link? Well, I mean, you could also argue that there's a link between non-refugees and terrorism, because there are plenty of...
In fact, I think the majority of terrorists tend to be non-refugees.
Obviously, the One Nation political campaign is that they want less immigration from... They want fewer refugees coming through. So they are trying to get people to think that there is a connection between refugees and terrorism. So the question is obviously aimed at them, at the suggestion that if we have more refugees, there's an increased risk of terrorism, therefore we should have fewer refugees. Like, that's clearly the pitch they're going for, and I think ASIO was just batting it straight back. Saying, no, that would be I'm not going to agree with that. That's a misleading thing. Refugee intake does not increase the risk of terrorism.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that, and I think the ASIO chief is correct that it isn't refugees that create terrorists within Australia or other places. In fact, there's been so few cases, I think, of... I think they found so few examples of people who were refugees being involved in terrorist acts. In fact, it's such a... convoluted and roundabout way to get someone into a country that takes years and years and years. The people who are terrorists, can you generally afford to get people here another way if they wanted to, that they wouldn't take that route anyway? Like, it just doesn't make any logical sense. You know, why would you lock someone up on an island for 4 years?
I think I wonder now, because I've said that I wonder now if their pitch is more, it's not necessarily that there might be, I think they're saying that these people are innately
More likely
to be radicalized. So, or their children, like, they've got terrible views, and therefore, here is the former prime minister. He declared that too many people pussyfoot around the fact that just about every terrorist incident of recent times involves someone killing in the name of Islam. We've had three terrorist attacks in Australia, and all three of them involved either people claiming to be refugees or the children of refugees, Abbott said. I think that the ASIO director really needs to think again on this issue. I don't think public officials help the debate by denying the facts.
That's interesting. And I also noticed that it's also what gets qualified as a terrorist attack, isn't it? Like you had, for example, like the church shooting in Quebec, which was done by a white man in Canada. And that's one of the few examples of someone actually being called by the media a terrorist rather than being called a lone wolf or, you know, mentally disabled. Because it's generally if it's a white guy who goes in and does something, it's, you know, he's unbalanced. He's a lone wolf. He's, oh, he was a nice guy. He did this thing. You know, they would never say that about these people. But, you know, if it's someone who, yeah, if it's someone who's Islamic, then absolutely, it is a terrorist attack.
And it's a very misleading description of recent incidents. So obviously, Man Monis, who with the Sydney, the Link Cafe, he was, he claimed to be a refugee. But there are lots of other things that are acts of serious violence, they're declaring that anytime a Muslim does something, it's violent, then it's terrorism. But, the bloke who drove through Melbourne killing people last year wasn't a Muslim.
No, and what about the guy in Wangaratta who killed his, you know, went had guns and killed his wife, you know? That's just, these are...
Unhinged people.
Yeah, these are just unhinged people.
And they've all got, there's plenty of violence that happens for political ends. It's not all, but apparently we've redefined terrorism to just be when a Muslim person does it. But we've had terrorism in Australia for decades. We had neo-Nazis bombing Asian restaurants and businesses and so forth during the 80s. We had the judge of the family court who was shot dead in the 80s by a person who was cranky about the family law system. Like, there's plenty of people who do get cranky and do violent things. The Barnaby of all people made what I thought was like a sane retort to this whole idea that, oh, if you can link them in one way, then that must be the cause. Because as Barnaby pointed out, it's like saying they are all blokes. It's like saying there is a link between testicles and terrorism. Good people in all communities provide information so we can keep Australia safe. With a few exceptions, that's working well for us, and let's keep that program going. But
the funny thing about that statement is while I wouldn't say there is a link between testicles and terrorism, I would say there is a link between, you know...
What do all of these terrorists have in...
Toxic masculinity in general, the culture that we live in, and just like general violence. Because if you look at a lot of the violence that happens, not even just terrorist violence, but domestic violence, etc., the majority of it is perpetrated by men. So, Barnaby, you might be a bit closer than you think.
Well, he's exactly right. Like, if you want to draw a link between all of these killings, they're committed by... Sorry, 90% of them are committed by...
Men.
Misogynist asshole men.
Yep.
Even the bloke who drove through the city killing people. Yep. The Man Monis who tried to kill his ex-wife. That's right, wasn't it? It was kill his ex-wife?
I believe it was. Estranged wife or ex-wife.
The link between family violence and misogyny and these men who then go on to commit other terrorist acts. Well, same with mass murderers in general. They often have started off committing violence against women. Like,
yep.
I think Barnaby's totally right. If you're worried about what will rein in terrorism, well... Look at
toxic masculinity. Look at the maleness in our culture. And so I think he, in his trying to be sarcastic and laugh it off, he's actually hit something on the nose.
Yeah.
Wouldn't he be pleased?
He would. Meanwhile, after the Manchester bombing, Quadrant, the far-right publication... Sorry, you probably wouldn't have read it because nobody does. But there's...
No, I don't.
Oh, there's a right-wing publication called Quadrant, which in right-wing circles in Australia has some standing. After the Manchester bombing, they were declaring how sad it was that they didn't take out Ultimo, the ABC building. It should have been in the Q&A audience or something.
Wow. That's...
It stayed up for quite a long time before they took that down.
People really are special, aren't they?
They are. Meanwhile, it's a bit quick update on housing in Sydney. So in some inner city postcodes in Sydney, households are paying more than 60% of their total incomes on rent.
That doesn't surprise me at all, having recently moved from Sydney.
No, there's a report that, the rental affordability is at a record low. But Gladys has a plan, New South Wales Premier.
She's going to help first-time home buyers by increasing stamp duty concessions.
Great.
Yay!
For first home buyers buying things like between 600,000 and 850,000. Yeah, so she's... Like. Who is the first home buyer who's saving up that money?
Yeah, and the other thing she said is... she made some comment along the lines in this article or in this interview press release that, you know, the house may not be where you want it to be and it may not be your dream house, but at least you'll have a piece of property.
And well, people what should, is the house going to be?
And so people should start looking at apartments and things instead of just houses, and they should start looking at other options. And so again, it's saying...
But the houses, apartments are stupidly expensive and you don't get any land.
Yeah, so she continues to say that things are broken, that we are going to try and give you a tiny bit more money to play with, which doesn't actually work because then the banks just loan you more money because you don't have to pay that stamp duty, which drives up prices, which we've discussed previously. But they're also saying, again, move further out, buy something you don't want, buy something in a crappy area, because you just need to get on that ladder.
But they're completely oblivious to the fact that even in a crappy area, it's unaffordable. Like, an ordinary person cannot save to buy it on, you know, a shack on fire in a swamp.
Yeah.
Like, within 300 kilometres of Sydney, it's ridiculous. Like, the quote from Gladys that I found really revealing, because we all know that putting more money in makes it worse.
Yes.
The only thing that will address housing affordability is getting investors out of the market. It's not that we have a shortage, which is one of the things that Greg Jericho pointed out in an article on The Guardian this week, that we've got, we may have a drop in apartment prices shortly, but not houses, not land, like just the apartments that are floating in midair over a bit of land that nobody actually has, that nobody owns. Like, yes, those things that are buildings that depreciate that are not, those things might go down in price. But again, not to a level where an ordinary person could afford them.
No.
But we all know that the fact that they're going to go down, that there's a glut of apartments, is further evidence that but that's not going to put house prices down.
Yeah.
It's further evidence that the problem is not supply. It's never been supply. The problem is too much money.
Yeah.
Too many investors. So it doesn't matter what house is there, investors come in and gobble them all up. And
what's the wrong kind of supply?
Well, the apartments.
Yeah, and a lot of them aren't great apartments. Like, they're either luxury apartments or they're not great apartments. Apartments that are, like, thrown together as quickly as possible, as cheaply as possible. And why would you want to purchase one?
But they're still very, very expensive.
They're still very expensive, yeah.
But the problem is clearly that that whatever supply there is, it's full of investment money.
But what did Gladys say?
Well, Gladys, who is well aware that throwing more money in does not actually help, actually said, "I've accepted I can't be so pure as to go by what works on paper." So she knows it doesn't work. She's announcing a policy saying, yes, I can't be so pure as to enact policies that I know work. So I must enact a policy that I know doesn't work. Because it's unnecessary purity for me to stick to policies that work as opposed to policies I know that don't work. How could a politician say that? "I've accepted I can't be so pure as to go by what works on paper." It's not, "I've been persuaded that maybe this is going to work." It's, "I know it doesn't work, but I'm doing it anyway.
But we have to do something because we said we'd do something when I took over being premier, and now I have to do something." Oh my gosh, it's a mess. It is a horrible, horrible mess. And for all my friends who are still living in Sydney, I feel for them because, yes, it is a...
It's happening here. It'll happen here as well.
Gosh, don't remind me. Because
Daniel Andrews is also reducing stamp duty for the first time buyers. One of the crappiest things he's done. But again, isn't it the bottom line is, it's same with Indigenous recognition and a treaty. The people who have all the power will not accept anything that actually fixes the problem because they don't want the problem changed. The people who benefit from Aboriginal people having no real rights and from them being dispossessed and who would at best not gain at all from a treaty or at worst lose something.
Mm-hmm.
Attitude is, no, they get stuffed. I've got my privilege and I'm not going to, I don't feel any guilt about it and I don't want it changed. So the only thing, you've got all the politicians saying to the Aboriginal people, look, can you offer us something that doesn't actually do anything? Can you offer us something that doesn't make white Australians unhappy because it actually doesn't benefit them or in fact actually helps you at their expense? What? So it's exactly the same with the housing. Like, we've got a system where the only thing that will work, which is making it less attractive for investors, is the thing that none of the politicians will do.
Because they're all investors?
Well, because they're investors, and because the investors' attitude is, you can tinker around the edges, you know, as long as it doesn't affect me. But we have to affect you because you're the people who are breaking it. Like, there have to be losers from this. At the moment, it's everyone who didn't own a house beforehand and also future generations and, you know, the general social fabric of the country. if we fix that, there are losers. It's the people who've been profiting off the current terribly broken system since Howard wrecked it.
Mm-hmm.
They would be losers. They have to be losers because the only way to fix this is for them to lose their this ridiculous benefit they've got at the moment.
Absolutely. And it is a ridiculous benefit. And it's actually really interesting, is going back to the Uluru thing and how there is post this statement coming out, the statement from the Heart, politicians immediately started saying, oh, well, this is interesting, but we're going to still keep looking at constitutional recognition. And a lot of the response was, see, there we go again. We have said this is what we want. We have come and self-determined that this is what we as Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people would like to have happen. We would like this treaty process to begin. We would like this recognition. And we have white politicians coming in and saying, that's really nice, guys. What we'll do for you, we'll give you some constitutional recognition. We'll keep going on that. And you see things like that, this sort of continual thing of, well, they'll be like, oh yeah, no, well, listen, we'll do something, but we'll only do something that doesn't actually affect us, that you don't actually have any opinion on. You know, if with the housing market...
We won't sacrifice anything of ourselves.
Exactly.
We won't undo any of our privilege.
Exactly. And so with the housing market, it continues to be, oh, well, listen, you know, like, they won't look at the next generation of renters or any of these people who aren't in the housing market. They'll just be like, oh no, well, we as investors... don't want to break down the current system that benefits us, so we'll just do these things like stamp duty, and then a few more people will get on the housing chain. We'll be like, look what we did. We helped you with allowing you to super sacrifice.
But bottom line, we don't actually want to substantially change the current system.
No.
But we know that you're angry about the current system, so would you accept these half-assed measures that don't actually do anything? Aboriginal people, would you accept us saying some nice things about you instead of actually addressing it?
Yes.
People who don't have, generation that is stuck out of housing, would you consider something that doesn't in any way actually alter the fact that we own all the investment properties and doesn't affect us at all and therefore doesn't actually help you, but would you accept some sort of minor things that look like they might help you? Would that be enough to trick you into thinking that we've done something about it? Eh? Eh?
That's pretty much all they're doing.
Meanwhile, the welfare drugs test thing. So we've had estimates this week. The Greens and Labor got to ask some questions of the federal government's plan to drug test... people who are receiving Social Security. Still don't know what the cost is.
They're oh, but they can't tell us the cost. Because if they put the cost in the budget, then when they put it out to tender, people will just put their tenders in for that amount and they won't get a fair deal.
What?
That's what they said. They said they couldn't release the cost because they still have to tender this out to various companies to get someone who will do it. And if they know what their government is planning on spending it, they'll just put their tender in for that amount.
But that's... Sorry, are these people who believe in the free market or not? Because if the free market works, then somebody could come in under the others. Like, presumably they'd be able to compete on price.
You would think.
Do they believe in the free market or not?
Well...
Competition? Isn't that how competition's meant to work? You say, this is what we've budgeted for it, but obviously we'll be giving the contract to the person who does the job at the best price because we are not incompetent.
And we're not Ian McDonald.
Yeah, what... Ian McDonald?
The New South Wales... government guy who got sentenced to 10 years for giving a mining contract away.
Hang on, that's...
Sentenced yesterday.
Isn't there a Senator McDonald as well in the federal parliament? Who goes in high-vis vests?
Yeah, this was New South Wales.
Was he Labor or Liberal?
Labor, he was Labor.
He was Labor, yeah. Okay. So maybe that's just an evil name. The drug thing, of course, that we don't know what it's going to cost. The government has come out and said, and I heard... I was very disappointed this week. I heard on the BuzzFeed Is It On podcast, also when interviewing Alan Tudge,
mm-hmm.
And she let him get away with a whole lot of nonsense about the drug testing. He was pretending that it was about ice, but if it's just about ice, it doesn't really make any sense as to why you're targeting cannabis. I'm not quite... The arguments against ice are not the same as the arguments against cannabis.
Definitely
at
not.
All. And he wouldn't... He was trying to pretend that... He didn't reveal any of these things that came out from Senate estimates, they didn't talk with the doctors about it first. They think there's going to be an 8.5% strike rate. Some people are going to have to be made to... They're going to be made to pay for tests. So you're on NewStart, you're already below subsistence payment. You might have to pay for these drug tests.
But apparently it won't be such a significant amount that it will hurt their payment. Like, it won't hurt it significantly.
But... The payment's like $250 a week.
Yeah, so basically, unless it's 5 cents.
That's insane.
Yeah.
They reckon that it was justified by the 2015 National ICE Task Force report. Well, I mean, again, if you're going after people on Social Security payments who are using ICE, no, they're not testing people on the pension. They're just testing people on Newstart. because this line that and Tudge came out with this. He was saying that it was that people who are working in industries where, you know, airlines and various industries where they're drug tested or on mines and so forth, well, they resent that the people receiving welfare aren't being drug tested. Well, why? They're not, like, so what you're saying is this is entirely out of spite. So you've got people who've got a job where their alertness and so forth is totally relevant and necessary for safety.
But I will say that in my 5 years at Sydney Trains, where we did random drug testing quite frequently of all the staff, from drivers to guards to people who work in back offices, people just show up and test you. Really great after a long weekend when you see the van outside your thing on a Tuesday morning. That no one ever said, wow, why aren't they testing those Dole bludgers? Not a single person. No one ever said that.
Their whole attitude is, there was a lot of things I'd like to ask Tudge, because Tudge was doing the thing where he's still pretending that people are, you know how they fudge? They say that the welfare bill is expanding, and therefore we have to go after people on Newstart, when, as we've said repeatedly in the podcast, the Newstart payment is decreasing. The amount of money that's going to people who are unemployed is actually decreasing. So using the fact that the overall welfare budget is increasing, these are not the people who are doing it. These are not the people to go after. These people are having tougher and tougher lives as it is.
And you're making it harder and harder for them to get back into the job market. You're making it harder and harder for them to be able to, you know, clean their clothes so they can go to a job interview, so they can take the bus to the job interview, so they can, you're just making it more difficult for these people to actually get by and live.
If somebody on Newstart who's got chronic pain and can't afford, or in fact has the side effects from other pain relief, and they're taking cannabis in order to manage that pain, which a lot of people do, you know what? That isn't a reason to punish them. It's not a reason to be telling them to get off it. It's not a reason they're not able to get a job. It's got nothing to do with it. This is just further being punitive spite. But the fact that you've said it on the basis of, the idea that people who are on mining rigs resent that people aren't going through these drug tests. So it's got nothing to do with helping them get back into work, although that's Tudge's line. Oh, well, you can't get to work if you're using cannabis. What? Hang on, if you use cannabis on the weekend, it's still detectable in your system. They're not testing for the amount that is going to affect you at a job interview. They're testing for even trace amounts. Yes. So it's got nothing to do with your ability to do a job. It's purely punitive. It's out of spite.
Yes.
And it's... Anyway,
what did Turnbull say about the policy?
Oh, that it's out of love. It's with love.
Yeah, based on love. They're doing it because they love these people and want to help them.
Liars. And the CSIRO has been drafting. The other thing that Tudge screwed up, of course, being the robo debt thing. CSIRO have been sent in to try and help fix the
data profiling.
Yeah.
Though I saw something really interesting in that article, which mentioned that they were talking about rolling it out to pensioners.
Yeah.
The robo debt matching.
Oh, they'll do it. But what Tudge is obsessed with, like, one of the other things he was saying in this interview is he was talking about how, was it Tudge? No, it was one of the other government backbenchers. This one, I think, was on Sky, where they were questioning about the increased amount of money that they put into IT for this sort of data matching stuff. And they're like, oh, well, Labor gutted it, and we're putting all this money back in because this is the way that we'll get savings. But you're going after the people who are a tiny percentage of the budget, the unemployed that you're targeting with the vast amount of money you're spending on this IT, they're not the reason that there's a deficit. They're not the reason that the welfare part of the budget is going up. They're not, certainly not the reason why the Debt of Defence part or why any of these other things are going up. You're like, we're going to spend all this money going after the people who are just the easy punching bags.
Absolutely, and it continues to be that. It continues to go after the people who it looks good to go after, who the people that it's easier to punch down to say these people are the villains and to make them out to be the villains. It's better press for them.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't mind paying my tax so much as long as the people who you've taught me to resent are getting kicked in the face.
Yes.
Ugh, what a country. Talking of what a country, Margaret Court.
Ah.
So, obviously, everybody listening to the podcast will be aware of the Margaret Court stuff where this apparently very good tennis player at some point has been using her position to originally call for a boycott on airlines that supported marriage equality because she's a fundamentalist pastor at this church in Western Australia and just really doesn't like LGBTI people. She's been declaring that there's lesbian players who are taking young ones to parties and converting them to lesbianism, and they're doing the devil is all round with It's mad crazy stuff. But anyway,
she doesn't hate homosexual people. She hates their sin.
Do you think? Yeah, she thinks they're devils.
Yes.
But so she started coming out with stuff, and all the politicians were like, you know, Malcolm Turnbull down, like, well, you know, she was a great tennis player, and it's completely unreasonable for her to for the arena, the public arena that is currently bearing her name, that people play on, including LGBTI people and people who support LGBTI people, as in people who are not dickheads, and the immediate support for her being able to say what she likes with no consequence whatsoever, and why would we change a public building just because it's named after a raving bigot? That hopefully is getting harder and harder because she's kept going. She's doubled down. And she, first of all, she's like, well, why, it's unreasonable for them to go after me because of my tennis. Why are they coming after my tennis? Like, the only reason people were listening to you in the first place was because of your tennis. The article that you, like, this...
The letter
glowing,
you wrote, yeah.
Yeah, the glowing thing on the front page of the Herald Sun talking about what a tennis great you are. It's all about you being this tennis legend. And then you're like, well, how dare you mention my tennis stuff?
My personal favorite with the entire thing is that she's going on and on about how they're not getting a platform to talk about the fact that they're against marriage equality when she's on the front page of the Herald Sun, on all these radio interviews, on all of these, like, all of just everywhere.
Apparently the project were rude to her because they mocked her ridiculous ideas.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, she's not the bloody victim. Nobody is campaigning for the law to discriminate against Margaret Court. Nobody's campaigning for the law to deny her the rights that other Australians enjoy.
No, exactly.
And nobody is also calling for her sporting achievements to be expunged. The way that they carry on, you would think that not having an arena named after her means that none of her sporting achievements matter. So every single Australian sporting hero from the past who doesn't have an arena named after them, their achievements have been completely forgotten.
Yep.
They did nothing.
Yeah.
We don't know who they are.
Exactly.
Basically, the only people who ever played sport in this Australia are the people who sport stadiums named after them.
Oh, well, that's good.
Which narrows it down a bit. It makes sporting history easier.
It does.
But it's insane. Like, the bottom line is, everybody should be boycotting anything to do with that arena. And they should... Tennis Australia, who's currently trying to ride it out, it basically needs to hit a point where they're like, we're actually losing money for it. Sod it, okay? You know, she did bring it on herself. Like, she didn't just do the first thing. She just kept going. Like, someone who declared that one of the other... I've forgotten who the tennis player was, but she had a child with her partner, and court declared that she denied that they'd taken a child away from its father.
That's what it all started with. It started with the fact that there was an article celebrating the fact that, you know, this woman had a child with her partner, another woman, and they're like, well, why are we celebrating this? Yes, we should celebrate there's a child, but
court declared that they'd stolen the child from a father. Yeah. Denied them a father. This nonsense. Anyway, it's insanity. And the idea that it just staggers me that in 2017... you can get away with saying that stuff. Like, if she came out and said, look, I think apartheid in South Africa is a great thing and we should totally be discriminating against...
Except she did.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Hang on. She did also do that.
Yes.
She
said historically that apartheid was irrelevant and she would just continue to go to South Africa. South Africa was a lovely place. The people were lovely and she would go there and keep playing because politics shouldn't come into sport.
But if she came out today and said, look, all I'm saying is I'm just remembering the Herald Sun. Maybe she could come out and say horrible stuff about Aboriginal people. What a horrible world. All right, well, let's move on.
To something more cheerful.
We were going through One Nation quickly.
Oh, okay, so that's not exactly more cheerful.
But they're mad. Like, so I'm not going to play... We'll just do it really quickly because I'm not going to play the grab of Pauline Hanson demanding to know whether the animals... whether cattle that were being killed... for halal were alive before they were killed.
Yeah, exactly. If they're being slaughtered, are they alive or dead when they're slaughtered? Do you not understand what slaughtered means?
That was clever. The department tried to diplomatically be like, they're all alive before we kill them.
Yes.
Anyway, meanwhile, they're directing donations to Pauline Hanson's personal account. She received $2,500, but in terms of donations, which is a small part of their donations, but she had them transferred to her account and refuses to say how the money was spent.
Yeah.
Their party whip, Brian Burson, came out earlier in the week declaring that the party had received unfair treatment from the ABC and that they would reject, quote, all bills associated with the budget unless the broadcaster's billion-dollar a year funding was cut by $600 million over 4 years. And then Hanson has come back and said, no, we won't do that, actually. Look, yeah, so they've backed down on that. But imagine trying to hold the government to ransom and be like, you have to destroy the ABC, otherwise you can't get a budget through.
Yep.
I mean, God, it's not like it's going to work on this government. The Liberals haven't passed a budget for 4 years.
Well, exactly.
Oh, wow. All right, let's do Sucking My Craw, because Greg Jericho from The Guardian, who did the podcast last week, the week before last episode, has returned, and he's a bit perturbed about the way we're using polls.
Today, my one thing that is stuck in my craw is polling. It's a thing that is ever in my craw, I think. I'm not sure if we'll ever be able to get rid of it. But I was reminded again of how stupid we use polling when we look at the coverage of the budget and how polls that came out after the budget were reported as though in some ways they determine whether or not the budget was a success or a failure. Now, sure, certainly there's no problems with looking at polls, especially around election time, although I think as soon as you start talking polls, you're off down the rabbit hole of the horse race coverage, which is something I think we should always avoid. But ascribing polls to a policy as to whether or not a policy is a success or a failure seems to me a very dim way of going about things, and it's something that we can't seem to avoid. And I wonder as well if for progressives it's also a bit of a trap in that they will seek to use policies that perhaps don't get much of a public reaction and view that as somehow indicative that the Turnbull government is failing. And I seem to think that that will actually set them up for a failure once they get into government. I think, yes, you need to win over public support, but quite often policies that were brought in weren't popular at all, or weren't massively popular until they were brought in. And I sometimes think that while we far too often focus on polls with regards to who's the leader and who's preferred prime minister, where we really have the biggest failing is when we start using them to judge policy.
I think he makes a good point. I think the idea of polls being polls indicating, for example, which leader you favor are one thing, but polls indicating, do you like this law or do you like this policy, are a bit silly. It turns what the government does into a very populist measure. They're just trying to do what's popular, what gets votes, what sort of, it's sort of like...
But they always do. Like, the question, I mean, without the polls... Like they just, I mean, all parties will do their internal polling on that stuff because they
that's
want to know
true.
Their policy. And that's
but
not
the policy, but the policy they should be doing is they should be looking at what's best for Australia, what's best for the vision that they have, and they should probably be enacting that policy. That policy might not necessarily be popular on the surface. People might not look at it and say that's the best thing, but it might turn out to be good for them.
Well, it's an interesting because we have the locked in 2-party system because of the single member mm-hmm. electorates where we turn a plurality of political views into two parties, basically. Mm-hmm. That's the effect of having single member electorates, and therefore you've got two parties that have a lock on it, and they need to sort of develop their policy. They have it before the election, but they kind of need to develop it also on the run because they're trying to cover a broad mass of the Australian people, and they don't mm-hmm. know at any particular moment which way within that broad church that they cover they should go. So if you're the Liberals, you don't know whether you should be going with the social conservatives on an issue or the social liberals that are economic conservatives. Like you, it's, and I guess the polling is the only way that they can try and figure out which way they can go so that they're actually
representing. I think that's perhaps more. I think that's more general polling. I think that's less going out and saying, "So, what did you think about this budget? What do you think about this specific thing?" And trying to get specific answers about an announcement that they just made.
Well, I think
and living and dying by that, like having, like I think that's the point too, as well.
And also that there's a limit in because that idea of an informed populace advising the government and then the government being represent, you know, polling the people, realizing what they want and doing it, relies on people being properly informed about what the government policy actually is. Yeah. And given that most of the time, like the carbon price, the renewable energy target. If you polled people on the renewable energy target, whether it should be higher or lower. Gut feeling is, oh, well, if you have a high renewable energy target, it'll push up energy prices. My energy prices are huge, so I'm opposed to that.
Well, that's actually the line the government sells.
I mean, if people don't have the context of realizing that the government's own research show that if you have a higher renewable energy target, it actually pushes down energy prices. If people aren't informed, then the polling doesn't give you any real
value.
It might tell you how people might vote on it at the next election and whether or not you should go ahead with it, but it won't tell you whether they'll stick with that afterwards when they realize that that policy actually was
Exactly. And I think what you have is you then have parties that are tempted to sort of turn in the wind, depending on what, like, what's said about this time, this policy now or this policy later. And that can change as well.
But that's why I don't vote for big parties, because I don't think when I vote, I want to vote for a party that I know which way they're likely to go on things. So I'll vote for the Greens because I know that they will be progressive on both social and economic issues. And pretty consistently, they do what I want them to.
Yeah.
If the Greens were trying to just be a broad left party and cover everyone, you know, including social conservative lefties, and like if they were trying to do what the ALP does and trying to be a broad church party, then whenever you vote for them, you don't know which way they're going to go on a particular issue in the future, because that will depend on the polling. They will depend on, you don't, like, they're trying to cover all the bases, and that's what the big parties do. That's why I don't think that big parties work democratically very well.
It starts to feel like it could turn into an episode of Black Mirror where you have you know, the government voting on things, and you have people at home with their phones pressing A or B, whether they approve, and, you know, numbers going up on screens, and votes changing in government as the, you know, the populace watches and changes their reaction.
Which is, you know, one of the broader ideas, I guess, of democracy, but it depends on people being informed if you're not going to have terrible outcomes.
Yeah.
Like, at the moment, if you poll people on brutally mistreating refugees, like, I think currently, oh God, it was a terrifying, it was like 50 or 60% of people thought we would... In a central poll, that we were too soft on refugees.
Too soft, or we weren't too hard on them at the very least. It was absolutely terrifying.
Oh, which reminds me, well, let's do Australia versus Humanity. So I'd like to point out the Greens petition calling on the LGBTI people who are currently held on Manus Island not being forced back by the government to the countries from which they fled, which are persecuting them. But currently, yeah, Dutton's attitude is that, well, if they don't accept, because Papua New Guinea, where they're being told that this is, you go Papua New Guinea or home. And if both of those places are places that persecute LGBTI people, that's not an acceptable outcome. I mean, shoving people on PNG is not acceptable for other reasons, but if their argument is...
You can stay on PNG where it is actually illegal to be homosexual, or you can go back where it's illegal to be homosexual and you face death, and you might face death or imprisonment on PNG, then what do you do?
It's monstrous.
It is absolutely horrible.
That one needs to be... I mean, it's not like Dutton's going to change his mind. In fact, Dutton's getting all... You saw that after GetUp are trying to get rid of Dutton, because he had a massive swing against him last election and he doesn't have a huge margin, and he's evil incarnate in pretty much every single way. And GetUp are trying to get rid of him. So the federal Libs are trying to get the Electoral Commission in Queensland to move the electoral boundaries around to make Dutton's seat safer for him.
It's amazing. It really is. And it not only makes his seat safer, but it disadvantages a bunch of other seats that they lost or are marginal. So it just advantages them across the board, but also disadvantages the other parties.
Well, it sounded to me from the link that it wasn't even gerrymandering so much, like... Gerrymandering being when you sort of try and move the boundaries around so you win more seats. This one was like, I think they were sacrificing some of their other Liberal MPs.
They were sacrificing, I think, one who was at a very narrow margin anyway, in order to ensure that Dutton stayed in. Yeah.
That's really good. But if this was America, where you had a party controlling the Electoral Commission, like that, they'd just be able to do that. And that's obviously one of the major problems with the American electoral system. Here, our Electoral Commission is supposed to be independent, so hopefully that attempt doesn't actually work. But it's just hilarious that they're thinking, well, not hilarious, but it's scary that they might be able to do that. Good to see that they're scared of GetUp, and frightening that we might be stuck with Dutton after all. Like, the fact that the Libs are willing to go to those extents, that indicates that they do see a future for Dutton. And I'd really like there to be no political future for Dutton, because there is nothing that man does that isn't evil.
Yes, but and sort of related to this, and a bit related to Australia versus Humanity, is people who are scared of GetUp, like the Australian.
Oh my goodness, yes. So I was going to go with the one about the arrogance of Dutton's office, but yes, you pointed me to this one.
In fact, yes, one of the new members of the board on the press council, who will be investigating various claims that are made against press outlets within Australia, is very exciting. She is the first Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander woman to be appointed to the council. She has a great history. She's been quite active in her community, but she's also a member of GetUp. So the Australian refuses to work with her because that GetUp is effectively another wing of the Labour Party and the Greens, the editor-in-chief of The Australian, Paul Whitaker, said in a report on Friday. GetUp's deputy chair, Ms. McGraw, will be sitting in judgment at the press council on complaints over contentious newspaper stories about important matters in the public interest, such as mining, climate change, immigration, and asylum seekers, all issues of which the organization she represents has aggressively campaigned on from a Green-left position.
As opposed to the Oz, that certainly hasn't campaigned on mining, climate change, immigration, and asylum seekers. So is the Oz basically saying, we are happy to lobby on all of those things, but we will not accept anybody who doesn't agree with our position.
Yes, and we will only accept someone. So if someone was, you know, a conservative person with similar sort of involvements, then she would be allowed, then they would be probably perfectly fine to sit on the council.
Well, frankly, I'm willing to bet that there's a whole lot of people who are on the press council at the moment who have clearly don't have a problem with... If you don't have a problem with the stuff that The Australian's publishing, then you've got to be fairly right-wing.
Yes.
And those should not be the only people in the press council.
Absolutely not. And as they said, you know, she's one of 25 members. So it is. They have 25 members who are appointed for a three-year period. That is a big council. That is a big group of people.
I love the arrogance of the Oz that left-wing people should not be represented at all. Left-wing people should never have a voice. Left-wing people, the idea of them having any say in relation to the decisions about media or anything else is outrageous. Should only be people who don't, who are happy with the current right-wing situation. Right. Talking of which, did you see, I thought this one would appeal to you as a Canadian-Australian. Can-Australian. There was a Canadian-Australian who rang Dutton's office this week and was complaining about the way that we're treating people in offshore detention. The report from The Guardian is, he said the staffer told him, so the staffer at Dutton's office, told him that he did not know what it was like in the detention centres as reporters are not telling you what's real. He said, if you let the reporters in there, we might get what's real, but they're blocking the media, so you just get to a point where you don't trust the government on anything they're saying. The electorate officer, he told the electorate officer that it made him embarrassed or ashamed to be an Australian to see this going on in Australian-run detention centres. To which the Dutton staff member said, well, why don't you just go back to the US then and deal with Trump?
Oh, God. Wow. That's a solution, definitely.
Why don't you Canadians go back to the US and deal with Trump?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll get right on that.
That's gold. I love the arrogance. So, okay, if you're a staffer in Dutton's office, you're supposed to just sort of take it and go, thank you for your feedback. Go back to America then. What?
And you know that there's probably someone looking up this guy's visa now to see if they can rescind it.
That is an outrageous conspiracy. That is actually quite plausible. Dutton's office. Yeah, no, in the current Department of Immigration, yeah. Sorry, Border Protection, yes. That is quite plausible. Well, that's probably a good place to wrap it up. Welcome to all of our new listeners. Thank you, everybody who's come back after a brief break for personal matters. Personal matters are slightly gurgling.
And starting to wake up. I think personal matters are starting to get hungry.
Yes, all right. Huge thanks to our Patreon subscribers, everyone who's given us a 5-star review on iTunes. Thank you, everybody who has tweeted about the podcast on Twitter. That helps. If you haven't done an iTunes review, that helps us enormously. It helps people find us. I did actually, when we were going to go away for this period, I was going to do a podcast giving other Australian political podcasts an opportunity to sort of promote themselves to our listeners, and I might still do that. Because if you look in iTunes under News and Politics, first of all, almost everything there is a crime.
Yeah, it's been taken over by, so if you look under News and Politics, almost everything is a true crime podcast.
It's very hard to find anything that's Australian. Most of the Australian ones are the professional news organisations. But even there, they struggle to get in the top. Like, so
top 50, they struggle.
So for sort of non-professional media Australian politics podcasts like ours, yes, reviews and so forth to appear at the top, higher up in that, so we're not all disappearing off the bottom underneath a plethora of crime stories. That would be very helpful and most appreciated. Thank you. So thank you if you do that. That would help us a lot. Thank you to my co-host for tonight, Denise. Thank you to our Stuck in My Craw contributor, Greg Jericho. Our beloved editor, Daniel Karma. Thank you, Robin Gray, for the music. Alex Lum for the artwork. And we look forward to seeing you all next week.
Good night.
Night.